This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up...
Iran says it needs stronger guarantees for a sustainable deal to revive the JCPOA, calling on the UN nuclear agency to end its, quote, politically motivated probes. A Palestinian prisoner on hunger strike for nearly 6 months ends his strike after Israel agrees to release him on October 2nd. And an Italian business group says around 120,000 service sectors firms could go out of business due to surging energy costs, causing the loss of 370,000 jobs. Hello and welcome to World News at our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran seeks stronger guarantees from the US to have a sustainable agreement to revive the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks during a press conference with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. He said Tehran is carefully reviewing Washington's response to an EU draft text on reviving the JCPOA. The top Iranian diplomat also urged the International Atomic Energy Agency to drop its politically motivated probes in order for Iran and other parties to reach a sustainable agreement. For his part, Lavrov said the two countries are working to create a reliable mechanism that will allow them to expand cooperation regardless of any diktats from the West. He said Tehran and Moscow have already identified clear guidelines in that respect. We asked journalist and political commentator Fred Weir to tell us more about the bilateral collaboration between Iran and Russia.
Russia was, of course, one of the facilitators and signatories of the original agreement. It was one of the great examples of cooperation between several different countries in coming together and striking that deal with Iran. And so Russia does have a role to play and an interest in seeing it revived. And hopefully it will be, because the world was a safer place, and the possibilities for Iran to re-enter the global mainstream, the marketplace, also a very important. So I think those consultations probably pretty important, getting Russia and Iran on the same page about how to proceed with this American offer. And it does seem like a very optimistic moment. Otherwise, there are several other things. You know that Iran and Russia have recently strengthened their bilateral cooperation economically, strategically. There's a new level there and a good deal to discuss about it. And there was also some suggestion that Iran might play a constructive role in helping to navigate toward some sort of negotiated peace in Ukraine.
A Palestinian prisoner on hunger strike for almost 6 months has decided to end his strike after Israeli officials agreed to release him. This came after Israel agreed to set a ceiling for Khalil Awada's administrative detention and release him on October 2nd. Until then, he will remain at hospital to recover. Awada has been on an open-ended hunger strike for 172 days in protest at his detention without charge or trial. Doctors had already warned that he could die at any moment. The Palestinian inmate had been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism and was placed under the so-called administrative detention 3 times ever since. Over 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without charge or trial. An Italian business group says about 120,000 service sector firms could go out of business due to surging energy costs, causing the loss of 370,000 jobs. The report by Italy's largest business association, Confcommercio, said the loss of jobs will take place over the next 10 months. It added that Italian service firms are expected to spend a total of about $33.21 billion on energy bills during the current year, 3 times as much as in 2021. The group called on Mario Draghi's government to extend tax relief to help firms tackle the energy crunch and make way for bills to be paid in smaller installments. The government has already earmarked more than 50 billion euros to cushion the impact of higher energy costs for firms and households.
Italy is coming last among all EU countries when it comes to average salary growth, according to a new study released by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, also known as OECD. The average gross salary in 2021, as stated by the OECD, was an upward estimate of 29,700 euros, which is practically the same amount of earnings recorded in 1991. Italy is also one of a handful of countries not covered in a new EU minimum wage directive to guarantee decent living standards for workers.
Many are struggling to make ends meet, living on starvation wages, particularly those with kids. Our government is dreadful. We must replace our politicians.
I am paid low wages in the order of 5-6 euros per hour. I worked in the hospitality sector and I work long hours, but I don't make much at the end of the month. Thank goodness I'm still living with my parents.
Italy is crippled by high inflation and skyrocketing energy costs. Inflation in the country reached 8% in June, the highest spike since 1976, with severe consequences on the cost of living.
The considerable spike of the inflation rate triggered by the rising cost of energy is now affecting food prices and weighing very much on families and businesses. Let me say the situation is extremely complex in Italy and in Europe.
Energy prices have risen to historic highs in Italy as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Businesses complain energy bills have gone up 10 times compared to last year. And in this scenario, thousands of companies risk going bankrupt in the coming months. Following the collapse of the Mario Draghi government in July, Italian voters will return to the polls on September 25 amid growing public discontent and profound distrust in politics. According to the latest polls, at least 16 million Italians, or 35% of total electors, are likely to skip the vote. Most of them believe voting is useless. Max Civili, Rome.
Elsewhere, as France ends its summer vacation period, a new survey is reminding the political class of the nation's unprecedented embrace of far-right ideas. The poll results show many believe France is headed for political turmoil, with mainstream Western liberalist politics more controversial than ever. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
French media is abuzz over an in-depth survey which reminded that 3 out of every 4 French people are so-called protest voters, in what appears to many as a major rejection of Western liberalist democracy. Perhaps more worryingly, with Western leftism widely considered confused and disconnected, the average French person has embraced ideas associated with far-right politics and economics. The poll shows the far-right's Marine Le Pen has the best approval ratings among France's top politicians, easily outdistancing both the leading leftist and the recently re-elected Emmanuel Macron. 40% of France now says they defend the same values as her party, the National Rally, a score considered unthinkable in previous decades. The survey also shows just how deeply far-right ideas have gained ground. Nearly 65% of voters see immigrants as a problem. Almost 60% think people can easily find a job, despite a long-running lack of quality full-time employment opportunities. And 50% believe that businesses need less regulation. In 2017, Macron promised to govern in a way which would reduce the influence of the two extremes of the political spectrum. But instead, the far right and the far left have grown to new highs.
The rise of the far right and their popularity of their ideas has put France in a state of institutional and cultural blockage. There isn't agreement on key issues anymore, and debates are now full of rancor and ill will. It must be stressed that in France there is simply not a culture of compromise as is in Germany.
Macron has repeatedly said that France is now living in an era defined by the end of abundance. due to the West's choice to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Many wonder if the widely expected upcoming years of shortages, inflation, and recession will provoke more protests of a left-wing nature, like the Yellow Vest movement, or of a new far-right nature.
The French government is in a desperate terror over what the social movements will look like this September. They were traumatized by the Yellow Vests, especially Emmanuel Macron. But at the same time, they are not making any concessions to remove the reasons for such widespread social anger.
The study notes that France's shift to the far right began to be noticeable around 2002. That is, shortly after the installation of the euro currency, and several years before the Lisbon Treaty confirmed the supremacy of the European Union in many areas of European life. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The city of Jackson in the U.S. state of Mississippi is still going through a water crisis. Residents there are facing the third straight day without water. Hundreds of vehicles waited in a long line at a distribution site where volunteers handed out cases of bottled water. Others were searching for water at local stores where supplies were depleted or sold out. The crisis started after a poorly maintained treatment plant failed this week, causing taps to run dry. Many businesses are shut down in Jackson and the surrounding area, which is home to some 180,000 people. The water crisis has caused local schools to resume classes online. Jackson residents say they are left in difficult circumstances and the government is not caring.
People are fed up. They're running to bordering cities who have clean water to just bathe and going to their grocery stores having to buy up all of the water because we have none. We need help. We need federal oversight. We need something to happen because for it to be going on for years and the governor not caring, the mayor hiring incompetent people to run the water treatment plants, it's like it's never ending.
The water treatment plant broke down from complications after a weekend of heavy rain and flooding. An emergency pump has brought the plant back to about 40% of its capacity. However, the distribution system is still short of sufficient water pressure to guarantee citywide service. Authorities say they expect water to be restored by the end of the week. President Joe Biden has declared an emergency for Mississippi, ordering federal assistance to supplement the state's response to the ongoing crisis. August 30th marks the one-year anniversary since the last American forces left Afghanistan, potentially ending the longest war and occupation in U.S. history. The pretext for its invasion of Afghanistan was the so-called War on Terror following the 9/11 attacks in the United States. However, despite two decades of military presence, the U.S. not only failed to eradicate terrorism, but brought bloodshed and chaos to Afghanistan and the region as a whole. We have a report on this.
The reason Washington wanted to remove the Taliban from power, who had given refuge to alleged 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden. After 2 months of incessant bombardment, the U.S. and its allied forces overturned the Taliban rule and replaced it with a cabinet filled with Western-educated Afghan individuals. But the U.S. finally realized that the Taliban are the force to reckon with. After months of negotiations, Washington bowed to the Taliban's demands and agreed to end its presence there. It was the mid-August in 2021 when Washington started hasty withdrawal and the Taliban started taking over the war-ravaged nation. Those Afghan officials, once at the helm, were nowhere, nor had tens of thousands of troops the U.S. trained to establish security in the country. But the occasion was joyous for many Afghans who believed they were at least free from the occupation.
I am very happy that I have come along with my friends to celebrate independence and the defeat of the Americans and their slaves. All the friends are here, and we all are happy that we are celebrating our independence standing in front of the U.S. Embassy. I'm so happy that I can't even express myself correctly.
U.S. Republican lawmakers blamed President Joe Biden for what they called humiliating exit from Afghanistan. That despite a deal with the Taliban inked with Biden's predecessor, who himself was a Republican. other than blame game, none actually suggested a solution for how the U.S. could have properly ended a feudal war that cost American taxpayers more than $2.3 trillion. Critics, however, say the U.S. must have not invaded Afghanistan in the first place, a view Biden seemingly expressed himself when asked about the pullout.
Can Al-Qaeda come back? Yeah, but guess what? It's already back other places. What's the strategy? Every place where Al-Qaeda is, we're going to invade and have troops stay there? Come on.
No matter what, Afghanistan will be a nightmare not only for Americans, but those who remain there with a devastating aftermath of the war. Violent attacks and explosions are still daily occurrences, and the country is on the verge of collapse amid unprecedented poverty it has not seen before.
If the economy is not able to recover and grow meaningfully and sustainably, then the Afghan people will face repeated humanitarian crises, potentially spurring mass migration and making conditions ripe for radicalization and renewed armed conflict.
Almost 80% of the national budget for Afghanistan prior to the Taliban takeover came from the international community. The crisis has multiplied since the U.S. and some of its allies have frozen billions of dollars in Afghan assets despite calls by humanitarian organizations to release those funds. It seems the U.S. shows no regard for Afghans dying from hunger. More than 70,000 civilians are estimated to have died and millions more displaced as a direct result of the war. That number continues to grow as the U.S. has not stopped attacking the country. In its most recent attack last month, the U.S. struck Kabul with several drones to allegedly kill an Al-Qaeda leader. A historic failure in Afghanistan and widespread opposition at home and abroad seem to not have taught the U.S. leadership a lesson. Washington is still maintaining strong military presence overseas and is not holding back from embarking on new conflicts in one or other region.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The deadly Israeli wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation, says Ramzi Barut, journalist, in an article published under the heading Deliberate Misrepresentation. Western media bias makes Zionist regime war on Palestinians possible. Here's more. While U.S. and Western mainstream and corporate media remain biased in favor of the Zionist regime, they often behave as if they are a third neutral party. This is simply not the case. Take the New York Times coverage of the Zionist regime's latest war on Gaza as an example. Its article on August 6 is Israel-Gaza fighting flares for a second day. It's a typical mainstream Western reporting on the Zionist regime and Palestine, but with a distinct NYT flavor. For the uninformed reader, the article succeeds in finding a balanced language between two equal sites. This misleading moral equivalence is one of the biggest intellectual blind spots for Western journalists. If they do not outwardly champion the Zionist regime's discourse on security and right to defend itself, they create false parallels between Palestinians and Israelis, as if a military occupier and an occupied nation have comparable rights and responsibilities. For New York Times and all mainstream Western media, there is no question regarding who the good guys and the bad guys are in that bloody fight. Palestinians, in their view, always have been the West bad guys. Per the logic of their media coverage, the Zionist regime does not launch unprovoked wars on Palestinians and is not an unrepentant military occupier or a racist apartheid regime. This language can only be used by marginal, radical, and leftist media, never the mainstream. The brief introduction of the NYT article spoke about the rising death toll, but did not initially mention that 20 killed Palestinians include children, emphasizing instead that Israeli regime attacks have killed a leader. When the 6 children killed by the Zionist regime are revealed in the second paragraph, the article immediately and without starting a new sentence clarifies that Israel said some civilian deaths were the result of militants stashing weapons in residential areas and that others were killed by misfired Palestinian rockets. On August 16th, the Zionist regime military finally admitted that it was behind the strikes that killed the 5 young Palestinian boys of Jabalia. Whether the NYT reported on that or not matters little. The damage has been done, and that was the Zionist regime's plan from the start. The title of the BBC story of August 16th, Gaza's children are used to the death and bombing, does not immediately name those responsible for the death and bombing. Even the Zionist regime military spokesman, as we will discover later, would agree to such a statement, though they will always lay the blame squarely on the Palestinians. When the story finally reveals that a little girl, Layan, was killed in an Israeli regime strike, the language was carefully crafted to lessen the blame on her, Israeli regime murderers. The girl, we are told, was on her way to the beach with her family when their tuk-tuk passed by a military camp run by the group Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which at the exact moment was targeted by Israeli fire. The author says nothing of how she reached the conclusion that the family was not the target. One can easily glean from the story that the Zionist regime intention was not to kill Layan, and logically, none of the 17 other children murdered during the three-day war on Gaza. Besides, the Zionist regime has, according to the BBC, tried to save the little girl. Alas, a week of treatment and an Israeli hospital couldn't save her life. Though the Zionist regime politicians have spoken blatantly about killing Palestinian children, and in the case of former Israeli regime so-called Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, the Palestinian mothers who give birth to little snakes, the BBC report and other reports on the latest war have failed to mention this. Instead, it quoted Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who reportedly said that the death of innocent civilians, especially children, is heartbreaking. Incidentally, Lapid ordered the latest war on Gaza, which killed a total of 49 Palestinians. Even a human interest story about a murdered Palestinian child somehow avoided the language that could fault the fabricated regime of Israel for the gruesome killing of a little girl. Furthermore, the BBC also labored to present the Zionist regime in a positive light, resorting to quote the occupation army's statement that it was devastated by Lion's death and that of any civilians. The New York Times and BBC have been selected here not because they are the worst examples of Western media bias, but because they are often cited as liberal, if not progressive media. Their reporting, however, represents an ongoing crisis in Western journalism, especially relating to Palestine. Books have been written about this subject. Civil society organizations were formed to hold Western media accountable, and numerous editorial board meetings were organized to put some pressure on Western editors to no avail. Desperate by the unchanging pro-Israel narratives in Western media, some pro-Palestine human rights advocates often argue that there are greater margins within Israeli regime's own mainstream media than in the US, for example. This too is inaccurate. The misnomer of the supposedly more balanced Israeli regime media is a direct outcome of the failure to influence Western media coverage on Palestine and the Zionist regime. The erroneous notion is often buoyed by the fact that an Israeli newspaper like Haaretz gives marginal spaces to critical voices, like those of Israeli journalists Gideon Levy and Amira Haas. Israeli regime propaganda, one of the most sophisticated in the world, however, can hardly be balanced by occasional columns written by a few dissenting journalists. Additionally, Haaretz is often cited as an example of relatively fair journalism simply because the alternatives, including the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, and other right-wing Israeli media, are exemplary in their callousness, biased language, and misconstruing of facts. The pro-Israel prejudices in Western media often spill over to Palestine sympathetic media throughout the West Asia region and the rest of the world, especially those reporting on the news in English and French. Since many newspapers and online platforms utilize Western news agencies, they often inadvertently adopt the same language used in Western news sources, thus depicting Palestinian resistors or fighters as militants. The Israeli regime occupation army as Israeli forces and Israeli war on Gaza as flare-ups of violence. In its totality, this language misinterprets the Palestinian struggle for freedom as random acts of violence within a protracted conflict where innocent civilians like Layan are caught in the crossfire. The deadly Zionist regime wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation. Though the fabricated regime of Israel has killed thousands of Palestinian civilians in recent years, Western media remains as committed to defending the Zionist regime as if nothing has changed.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Well, we have heard about the events of Karbala and women who had played important role in it. But there's a question that were there women before the moment of Karbala? Were there women during the Karbala? We know that. But were there women post-Karbala and what was their role? We got to talk about all that in our studio with Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. And thank you for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Siddiqa. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation. A very warm welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so we discussed about the role of women before Karbala, in Karbala, and post-Karbala. Now, Siddiqa, since you discussed all those roles, every role, every single role, had so many lessons. I would want you to tell us a few of lessons that we actually learned from these roles of women in Karbala.
Yes, so if we go back, like I mentioned in one of the previous episodes, when Hazrat Zainab was mounting the ladies on the camels, yeah, it signifies the importance they give for hijab, even in times of difficulty. Now, I understand today the environment is very difficult. I'm not belittling people's struggles with the hijab. But when you're going through a struggle with the hijab, go back to Hazrat Zainab. Look at how she struggled. Even in the most difficult of environments, she keeps her hijab intact. It is true, according to the authors of this book, Maqtal al-Jami', it's written in Farsi under the guidance of Ayatollah Ray Shahri.
Okay.
They say that the hijab that was snatched from the women post-Karbala was what is equivalent to the Iranian chador that we wear today.
Okay.
In Qom. Those who haven't seen it, you can just Google what an Iranian chador looks like. Yeah. And this is what was snatched from there. But this in itself was very heavy for them, for these women, because these women were the epitome of chastity.
Okay.
So when you're going through a struggle with the hijab, when your friends are around you, you know, peer pressure is very difficult. We've all lived through these stages in life. Just go back to Hazrat Zainab and see how she went through these struggles, putting Allah in front of everything. You know, it is said when they were in Kufa.
So basically clearing her of any one of the doubts that is often seen over here, or that's so many know-hows are written over it. When I met Arabs for the first time and I saw Arabs, different kinds of Arabs, like Arabs from anywhere, I saw them. I saw their hijab. They put on a very long, what is called as abaya kind of thing. And then over that abaya, they put on this chador, what we have in Iran. So what was snatched actually was this outer,
yes,
chador.
Just the outer layer.
Because Imam had promised her that it won't be...
Your honor will be saved.
True.
Your honor's not going to go.
Sure.
And I do understand, you know what, I will put one point here, which might not be very related to our topic. But what is unfortunate is that that people belittle the events of Karbala by ascribing lies to the Ahlul Bayt. They want to make people understand the history of Karbala. You know, they rely on the hadith that say, if you make people cry, you will go to,
yeah,
paradise. But the hadith doesn't say you make people cry by lying
changing
about it.
Changing the history.
Yes, because ascribing lies to the Ahlul Bayt is such a great sin that if you are fasting, your fast becomes invalid.
True.
And these people who ascribe lies to the Ahlul Bayt think they're doing a favor,
yeah,
but what they're in fact doing is creating their own hellfire.
All right.
Right? Do not change history. History is not here to be changed. So now we go back, when we're talking about the
It's okay to talk about the tragedies, but you cannot change the history.
Not change the history. Don't put your own, you know, spices into this history.
Exactly.
The tragedy of Karbala is so tragic, we do not need lies to it,
added to
it. Right?
It's already brutal and tragic in itself. We don't need to add more
but
spices.
But it is also a story of love.
True.
Love for the Wali of Allah. let's focus on those topics. Let's focus on understanding the importance of the Wali of Allah, the one who Allah has chosen to represent him on, who is the manifestation of Allah. Yeah. Let's focus on the truth, not on the lies.
Yeah. So talking more about the roles, talking more about the lessons, we will get back to that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. We're talking about the lessons we learned from the role of women in Karbala.
So focusing on the hijab aspect itself, when Hazrat Zainab refused to let the army of Umar Asad touch the women, and instead she herself mounted them on the camels when they were getting ready to be taken to Kufa. Now we fast forward towards Kufa itself. Sahal ibn Sa'd was one of the companions of the Prophet who was there in Kufa. He sees the family of the Prophet being brought in. He goes to Fatima Sughra. We mentioned her before a few times.
Yeah.
He tells her, I am the companion of the Prophet. Tell me, what can I do for you? She tells him, you know that man carrying the head of our father, Imam Hussein? Tell him to go forward so people's eyes go on him and do not turn towards us.
Okay.
To protect a hijab, they're finding different ways. Again, this signifies how much importance they gave to hijab.
Yeah.
These women, well, like I mentioned, they were the epitome of chastity. For them, they understood that hijab is a role. I'm not belittling other people's struggles with the hijab. But like I said, when you're feeling yourself struggling with the hijab, go back and look at history and see how people fought to save this hijab. Whatever others may say about it, whatever they might try to bring it forward as an oppressive statement. Now, over here, we're discussing only the women's hijab. We're not focusing on the men's hijab because this is a women's program.
Yeah.
But whenever you're going through the struggles, go back, have a look at history and see how we can learn from history and how much importance what was given up to protect this hijab for me and you to wear it today. Then we can go on the other
lessons that we learn.
You know, when Imam Hussein was leaving for the battle, he tells Hazrat Zainab, do not say anything that will bring down your status. What he's basically telling her is that don't use words that will bring down your status. And Hazrat Zainab complies with this. Even if you see her sermon was very powerful, but she didn't use any swear words. You know, every time we go through, when we're angry at a person, I think we can fire a line of 5, 6, 7 swears.
Yeah, yeah.
Over here, she's minding her tongue. These are people who have killed her brother. You know, he is her brother, even if he's an imam.
Yeah.
They have killed her brother in front of her. She's witnessed it. But nowhere through her sermon do we see her using swear words.
True.
And this is how she maintained her tongue. And we need to learn that when we are talking to people, there is a way to talk. We do not need to employ
ethics.
Yes, we do not need to employ words that Allah has forbidden us to use.
Yeah.
There's no need to swear. We can use other words that put our meaning forward without using words that tomorrow on the Day of Judgment is going to come and, you know, take us closer to that hellfire that we've been trying to avoid, basically. That's another lesson that we can learn. One more lesson I'd like to indicate. Again, I go back to Hazrat Zainab because her life is very extensive.
True.
Before Imam Hussein leaves, he wills to her, whenever you recite Salatul Layl, remember me. This in itself is an indication that Hazrat Zainab, throughout the journey, wherever she was constant in her mustahabat and her wajibat. Even Salatul Layl. Even if she's traveling through the most really difficult situations, she does not forget that namaz is that pillar of religion that she's going to keep hold on to.
Sure.
Even in some cases, we do know that she's had to sit down and pray the namaz because she was extremely weak because of what had happened. And she sat down, but she didn't leave her namaz. It's unfortunate today, you know, our children get sick, right? They've reached the stage of maturity. Namaz is wajib on them.
Yeah.
But we tell them, it's okay. You know, one namaz you leave, you can do qadha of it. No, don't teach your children to leave the namaz.
True.
You're sick. Make them, you know, help them to pray. Don't teach them to leave that namaz, because tomorrow they're going to find excuses, like that man found excuses when he wanted to take the anklets of Fatima Sughra. Justification. Do not allow the justification to enter the tarbiyah of your children, to enter the upbringing of your children.
True.
Today you justified for them, tomorrow they will justify it for themselves.
Exactly.
But then you have to answer on the day of judgment that I taught my child the wrong lesson in life.
Yeah. I'll be talking to you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. We're talking about the lessons we learn from the roles of women in Karbala.
So yes, we were talking about the importance of namaz. You see, namaz has been given this importance of as being the pillar of religion. If your namaz is correct, you will see yourself not sinning through the day.
Exactly.
And we know that Hazrat Zainab never left her prayers. None of the Ahlul Bayt left the prayers.
I mean, Siddiqa, just look at this. I mean, when we go through some tragic event, a very simple, like not as tragic as Karbala, like nothing has happened like that to us. But still, if somebody's father dies or somebody very close dies and the person is broken, and then people do not even remember the wajib namaz. They don't even remember the obligatory prayers.
Forget the mustahabat, exactly. They don't even remember the wajib that they have to do.
Exactly. So, like, just and they have, like, as you rightly mentioned, that they are justifications. They're just no, just don't pressurize the person. He's gone through such a big tragic event and all that. So we have justifications ready. And Imam Hussain alayhi salam is telling his sister, remember me in your night prayers.
Because he knows she's going to pray it. He knows that she never missed her Salatul Layl.
But how could she do it? I mean, she's weak. She does not have enough strength. She has gone through so many tragic events. She has not seen one person dying. She has seen all the companions. She has got beaten. She
was also at the head of Imam Hussein when he was being killed. When Imam Hussein was being killed, she was there at his side. She goes out. She tells Umar Asad, are you going to see my brother being killed? Are you going to see the son of the Prophet being murdered in front of you and do nothing about it? She saw her two sons, her cousins, her nephews, her brother. Then she's whipped after that. And yet she doesn't forget her namaz. And this comes back to the upbringing her father and her mother gave her.
Okay. So upbringing actually plays a very important role.
Very important role. A lot of the times we'll allow our children to justify the behavior. But it's okay. You know, he's just become baligh. He's just gained maturity. You know, he can't
still a child.
Fast. Yeah, he can't do fajr. Leave it. Well, you know, you do qadha. It's okay. Yeah. You know, you can pray it later. No, don't justify it for your child. Let them see that if you justify it, they will justify it later. And we see these, even Imam Hussein, we know this. And we see on the day of Ashura, the arrows being fired at his tent. And they recite namaz while the arrows are being fired at them. And we have a line of companions who stay at the last line and they take the arrows while the imam is praying namaz.
Okay.
And these people understood the role of prayers. And this is why they were able to go with Imam Hussein. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Because their prayers helped them understand. Like we have, As-salatu mi'araju mu'min. Salah is
something that takes a believer to mi'araj.
The higher levels, the higher realms.
True.
And this is what their salah was on the higher realms.
Inshallah, I'll discuss more about the role of women with you in coming sessions. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the Messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
Allah.
the Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A normal childhood in Gaza is rarely attainable, given the Israeli regime's 15-year siege, which strips children of not just urgent medical care, but emotional well-being. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Ahmad Al-Samak and Wala Sabah, journalists. This article is published under the heading A Whole Life Under Israeli Regime Siege. Stay tuned for more. Jude Al-Amarin, 6, was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia in July 2020. Before her diagnosis, she had lost weight, her limbs were swollen, and she was tired all the time. Doctors in the Gaza Strip, where Jude and her family live, said she would have to seek treatment at Al-Najah Hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus. Jude's mother, Tahani, applied for Israeli regime travel permits to accompany her daughter, and the first three times, the approval process was relatively quick, yet the family's most recent application needed for Jude's fourth appointment on April 2nd was different. Tahani waited almost 3 months for approval, only to be informed that her application was under review by the Zionist regime for security reasons. She said, "We are a poor family whose ultimate goal is to treat our daughter and get our daily livelihood, nothing else." Neither I nor my husband have done anything wrong. We don't have any political interest. Why was I denied? A life has turned into hell because of Jude's condition. The Zionist regime's 15-year siege on the Gaza Strip has had devastating effects on children, and its denial and delay of needed medical travel permits only intensifies children's physical and mental suffering. Yasser Abu Jami, director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, said anxiety and stress rise during the waiting period to get the permit. They need their mothers or fathers behind them during their treatment, Abu Jami said. Jude's father, Abdullah, 34, acknowledged that these delays threaten Jude's life, but he feels powerless. He used to work in a blacksmith shop, but after he was shot in the leg by an Israeli regime sniper during the Great March of Return in 2018, he could no longer work, he said. The Israeli regime siege has deprived our children and us of everything, treatment, electricity and work. Eventually, the Al-Amarin family sought help from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights to sort out their travel permits delay. The organization filed a petition with the Zionist regime's high court. Only then, in June, was Tahani's companion permit granted and Jude able to seek out the necessary treatment in Nablus. Before that trip, Jude, who sat at her mother's side, explained how she was behind on her reading and writing abilities and just wants to attend first grade like her peers. Last year, she only attended kindergarten for a few weeks due to lengthy and painful bouts of treatment. She said, "I am tired. There is unbearable pain in my chest. I don't want to play to avoid any more tiredness." A normal childhood in Gaza is rarely attainable given the Zionist regime's 15-year siege, which has stripped children of not just urgent medical care but emotional well-being. 80% of young children in Gaza suffer from emotional distress, 59% have had thoughts of self-harm, and 55% have had suicidal thoughts, according to a recent Save the Children report on the consequences of the Zionist regime's blockade and assaults on children in Gaza. Gaza-based psychologist and social worker Inas Faragla said the need for psychological intervention among children in Gaza has soared due to consecutive wars and the siege. She said, "I worked with many children whose conditions were unbelievable and preyed on my mind. I often feel powerless as I can't help them. They need intervention, not individuals or psychologists." Faragla said she commonly sees a lack of self-reliance and sense of belonging, deep sorrow, and inability to engage with society and emotional imbalance among children in Gaza. Ahmad Al-Gharabli, 14, usually works at his father's sewing workshop in Shujaiya, a neighborhood in Gaza City, after school. "I don't play with my friends, so I can't help my father," he said, adding, "Sometimes I don't have pocket money for school and I can't buy things like my classmates do, which hurts." Before the Zionist regime siege, Ahmad's father, Maher, earned up to $7,100 a month. Since he can no longer export clothes to the West Bank, he now earns less than $200 a month. Maher sold 13 sewing machines to pay his debts and provide for his family of eight, Yet, they still depend on monthly food vouchers and aid from Qatar and from anti-poverty group Oxfam. His sewing workshop used to have 20 workers. Now, it has 2 and Ahmad. Ahmad said he wants to go to university and work abroad to help his family. But sometimes I think I may not meet my promise because if any war erupts, we all might be killed, Ahmad said. For fun in Gaza, Ahmad and his family go to the sea or Gaza Park because those are the mostly free options. Recently, along with 2 other pupils, she made a prototype of a smart house with a sensor lighting system and automatic irrigation. It took them 3 months, 4 hours a day to complete. After winning a local technology competition, they were given the opportunity, along with 28 other pupils, to display their prototype at the Science House in Birzeit in the West Bank as part of a student science fair. All they needed were the travel permits. The night of June 7th, Noor received a text message stating that the Israeli regime had denied her a travel permit with no justification. She said, "I burst into tears for hours. Why? Why was I rejected access to the West Bank? My father is a teacher with no political interest, and I am just a 15-year-old girl." Noor has never traveled outside of Gaza. She was excited to meet other students in the West Bank and to talk about the competition. Noor said, "All at once, I felt that my efforts were in vain. The most significant difference between us and non-Gaza students is that they have freedom, but we don't." Medhat, Noor's father, was frustrated with the entire situation. He asked, "What security threat could a 15-year-old girl pose to the Zionist regime? She was born under the siege and was supposed to travel to the West Bank to see the rest of Palestine, our country. That was her sole opportunity to see the world. Why did the Zionist regime prevent her?" Noor wants to be a doctor. She tries to stay hopeful amid the Israeli regime siege, but the recent permit denial was a major blow. Noor's 8-year-old brother, Mohammad, refused to go to school after the Israeli regime's May 2021 attack on Gaza. Noor said, "My mother asked him why. He replied to her, 'Why should he wake up at 6 a.m. for 10 years and then, in the blink of an eye, he might be killed or at best be unemployed like our uncle?'"
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.